You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Hunted. I'm Simon from York.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. York, did you say?
Yes, York.
Where is that?
North of England.
It's in Yorkshire.
Yorkshire, yes.
Ah, okay. Now that made more sense. I I don't know if it was like the new New York or newest New York or what.
Well, it's the old New York, right?
Yeah. Okay, so Simon, you wanted to come on for this episode. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I've been a Star Trek fan for as long as I can remember. I grew up watching The Next Generation on BBC Two over here in the UK, and I've kind of been hooked on Star Trek ever since. I chose this particular episode because I think it's one of those episodes that I think gets overlooked. It's really quite good, but it's not one of the top ones that you'd always pick. I came across this one because back in the UK, the BBC banned The High Ground. I think it's the next episode after this. So for some reason, I went out and I bought the videotapes, which included The High Ground and also this episode. But I think this episode's a better episode than that one. That's why I've picked this one.
Okay. So do you do anything in podcasting or do you just listen?
Mainly listen. The first Star Trek London convention that they did was where I heard about Trekmate. And kind of since then I've been listening and I've made a couple of guest appearances on 10 Forward and the new DS9 Upper Pylon 2 podcast. Liking what you're all doing. Very good.
Yeah, we occasionally get you in the forum, so it's nice to hear from you. And it's good to have you on. I'm sure you probably heard recently Kieran McDuff was on.
Yes, I did.
That was fun to have him. So, all right then.
And Simon, you know, you and I have met. We met last.
Yes, we met.
We both. Yeah, we both went to. It sounds like we both went to both Star Trek Londons, but I didn't meet you in the first one, but we certainly pumped into each other in the second.
Yes, that was great seeing some of the Trekmate people in the flesh, so to speak.
And I believe your wife was there, dressed as a Tribble, a life-size Tribble.
Now that sounds fun. All right. So the synopsis for The Hunted is, while the Enterprise-D is reviewing a seemingly idyllic planet's application for Federation membership, an escaped prisoner leads its crew to discover an ugly secret, the government's shameful treatment of its war veterans. Gee, I wonder where they get that synopsis from. This is the 11th episode of Season 3 in TNG. It was first aired on January 8th, 1990. It was written by Robin Bernheim, directed by Cliff Boyle. Guest stars for tonight's episode are Jeff McCarthy as Roga Danar, James Cromwell as who does he remind you of?
Zephyrin Cochrane,
yes. James Cromwell as Zephyrin Cochrane, but he's incognito this week as Nayrok. Cole Meany as Miles O'Brien, not just Transporter Chief. J. Michael Flynn as Zainair, and Andrew Bicknell as Wagner. Ugh, I hate reading names. So, what do we think about this episode? Simon, you start. You're the guest. What do you think so far?
I like this episode. I think it's got a good mix of action and also Star Trek moralizing. So I think it's got a good balance of all that you'd want in an episode, I think.
Okay. Doctor?
I can see where Simon's coming from in this. I do think that it is it's a bit strange, right? I think it's kind of like it's almost two separate episodes. There's kind of the front and the back end of the episode, which has a lot of action in it, and then you've got this kind of gear shift in the middle when they go and they discover the quote shameful secret around it. So I think it's fine. I think the episode's fine. I'm not going to be too critical of it. I think the gear shift is a little bit harsh. I don't think it goes as smooth as it could have done. And I think that the lack of kind of like a supporting, kind of like a secondary plot around it makes it slightly dragged. But overall, I think this is a perfectly fine episode. Over to you, Lou.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a very good episode as well. And being in America, where we're not very great to our war veterans, I can't help but wonder if there was a political message that's... I mean, we don't certainly put them in prison, but I can't help if there's some kind of message about the way you treat your veterans.
There's a complete message. I think it's extremely clear what they're doing here
in
this episode. And of course, yes, you don't have to go as far as suggesting you lock everyone up that's suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. But, I think there are clear parallels of what they're trying to say. And in particular, the idea of, rehabilitation after service, whether that's emotional or properly psychological, or even just down to, getting used to, the time outside of... outside of the military structure, I think there are clear messages that they're trying to push across.
Right. I mean, one thing I really don't like to do on this show, as you well know, is I don't really quote Memory Alpha very much, because I feel like, this is not news to us. You can go to Memory Alpha and read these things. You don't need us to tell you the obvious. But first thing in the story and production, Michael Piller even says, this is an allegory to the U.S. veterans of Vietnam War and how it was that they returned back to us. In Life on Mars, and I'm talking about the U.S. version, the lieutenant even makes a point of saying during World War II, the soldiers came back to women who were more than willing to share and welcome them back, and the whole country was behind them. And in Vietnam, they were spit on and they were, attacked, and it was harder for them to come back to this. So, I could see what they're saying here. So, okay, we're at Angosian 3. Now, okay... Doc, have you ever explained to me why we're at Angosian 3 instead of just Angosia?
No, I don't think I have. But my understanding of it is that the solar system, and obviously I'm using the word solar system incorrectly, but the star system that they enter into will be, is it Angosia? And then what you end up doing, you end up counting the planets from the innermost planet outwards. So we would effectively be like Sol 3. And if there had been another planet between us and the sun, we would be Sol 4, that kind of thing. So I think that's generally how it's expected to work. I don't know if this ever made it into canon.
Mm. So what do you think the people on Angosian 3, what do they call their planet, just Angosia?
I suppose you're stumbling upon the nitpick, which is that everyone... the human race doesn't have a name for our planet. that is a name that is respectful of the fact that there are other cultures elsewhere, right? So, you know, our country and, you know, America and, you know, America and Spain and Canada and all sorts, we have ways of naming our country. And when you name them, you're always aware that you're naming it again and someone else has got another name elsewhere. So you don't just call it things like, you know, country. Although, in complete honesty, we're living in the, quote, United Kingdoms, and that's a little bit weird in the sense it's only like you'd only expect one kingdom. But anyway, we call our planet Earth. You would imagine that every single planet in the world would be called Earth or something similar. I always find it very strange that when alien races find it very easy to call their planet a name, and we've actually, you know, we've fundamentally not adopted that yet. We just call it Earth as a way of, you know, as a way of recognizing that we're on a sphere. So I don't know, maybe in 200 years time, Earth might go out of fashion and we might call it something, you know, like, you know, Duke World or something. I don't know.
Interesting. So I guess the Zindi didn't attack Sol 3. They attacked Earth. Okay. Simon, anything on it?
I kind of think that it's probably the universal translator. They call their planet whatever it is, and the universal translator translates it to Angoja 3 or whatever. That's how I kind of think of the names of planet works.
That makes sense.
That's always a good way out. And you can then also throw into it like cultural references as well. So an alien will be making a cultural reference and they'll happen to refer to Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz. And they won't be referring to Tin Man, of course. They'll refer to something in their own culture and the universal translator takes care of it. Yeah. So you don't have to worry about this.
You know what's interesting, though, on a tangent, though? If you ever go to Google Translate and type something in from English to Spanish, and you get a completely different, you know, you get the Spanish saying for that saying in English. But then when you copy and paste that Spanish saying, put it over to the Spanish one and translate it back to English, sometimes you get a different word than you started with. So, I don't know. Translator is not all that hyped up. But anyway, so while they're taking a tour of the capital city, there's an escaped prisoner from the penal colony on Luna 5. Maybe the penal colony is not as good as Luna 5 as it is on Luna 6 or 7 or something. But anyway, two guards are dead and the prisoner is still in a transport vessel. At this point, should we have been involved?
Okay, so let me kind of put out my main nitpick or my main kind of poking fun at the episode. In the teaser, you kind of get introduced to this society and you know straight away that despite, you know, all of the things that have been said about them, you know that they're a great society, but you know they're hiding something, otherwise there wouldn't be an episode. So you kind of know exactly what's, well, not exactly, but you know the kind of the, what you're in for in this episode. And then there's the bit where, you know, they basically say, well, you know, thank you, we've concluded our investigations and they're about to leave. And then, you know, someone's told, oh, by the way, we've got a, you know, we've got an escaped prisoner. And really what Picard should have done here, it said, okay, well, farewell, Prime Minister. We'll see you around. And that's it. And they would have just warped off and it would have been a very short show.
Yeah, good luck, guys.
Yeah, it started off as just a simple favour of, oh, we've got this problem. Can you help as you happen to be visiting? But then later on the episode, it turns into, oh, this is an internal affair. We don't need your help anymore. So it should have probably been an internal thing from the very beginning, but there'd be no episode if they did that.
Gotcha. Yeah, so anyway, Picard calls up the Data and says, hey, there's an escaped prisoner. Do you think you can catch him? And Data says, ha, not a problem. So what do you think of all this cat and mouse game at this beginning part with the transport ship into the little shuttle, into the escape pod? I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes, I agree. I thought that the first part of the episode was, you know, was pretty good, and it's kind of like, it's quite unique in the sense it's kind of like elongated action. So there are multiple phases to each of the kind of like deceptions and tricks and catches. So not only does he kind of like go behind the asteroid and tries to bluff them, and then he gets caught out a little bit later, and then he tries to bluff them again, and then he finally does get caught, and he fights his way through, and there's a lot of kind of stop starts, and I think it's unique, and I think it works okay, but there's always a part of me in the back of my mind thinking, are they just trying to stretch this out? But I was, you know, I was pretty happy to go with it while it was on screen. This is despite the fact that Data seems to be beaten by a bit of a, like a magician's bluff, right? Or a lot of the diversions is, oh, look over here, look over here, and then it's like sleight of hand, and he's actually gone the other way. But it's at least good that Data kind of learns in this, right, episode. He kind of like, starts preempting what's happening.
Oh, yeah, because obviously, you know, he's overmatched. Daynar doesn't have a chance with the Enterprise, but he gets behind that little boulder and, or the asteroid, and next thing you know, he's gone. The ship is gone, but they do eventually find it above their North Pole, I suppose, maybe visiting their Santa Claus, but yeah. So, but it seems to me when they finally get a tractor beam on the escape pod that it was actually right in front of the Enterprise. So it seemed like, you know, maybe the sensors couldn't detect him, but perhaps maybe someone should have looked out a window. There he is! You know, and 10 forward. There he is!
I think they just didn't have the budget for the special effects. Because you're right.
To show him in the window?
Well, no. They say that he's over the pole. He's over the pole. He's over the pole. And then it's like, okay, put a tractor beam on him. And it's like, oh, no, he's ready here. He's, you know, he's tried to escape, and he's made his way to a position straight off the, you know, straight off the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So he's a prisoner, and his criminal record is just too long to get into. Did you fall for that at the time? You know, his prison record is just too long. Criminal record is just too long to get into. Because to me, I mean, I thought, well, he obviously is a criminal. He did some bad stuff, and they're trying to get him back. We can't let him escape. Simon, how about you?
I think they mentioned something about he's uncontrollable. His uncontrollable violence or something, and they should keep him sedated and all that. And it's just don't question this person. Don't find out what we're up to here. It's all the government trying to keep their secrets from the Federation, kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, I thought that too. I had that in my notes. Keep him sedated so you don't stumble on what's really going on. Okay. Doc?
I mean, I completely agree. I think that the James Cromwell character, you know, he's clearly behaving a little bit suspiciously. I would go as far as suggesting that, I suppose, in the real world, if the Prime Minister is brought in, so it's the Prime Minister of the entire planet is brought into one of these affairs, it's probably something a bit more kind of important. But, you know, unfortunately in Trek, we always see the leaders of the planet getting involved in all of the nitty-gritty affairs. I mean, I think it was, what was it? Was it Angel One when the woman even was happy to have the execution conducted in her office, which seems very unlikely. So had it not been Star Trek, you think, well, why is the Prime Minister involved? It seems suspicious that he would want to be. And then a lot of the warnings, they're kind of going out of their way to make to beat this guy up. They also mention, they mention things about his criminal record. So no details really are given. It's just, oh, he's a criminal. It's very, very bad. We won't bore you with the backstory. And then don't ask him about his backstory either. Keep him sedated. And I think that's supposed to probably kind of throw you into the questioning role here.
Yeah. What do you think happened to Transporter Room 3 today? Because O'Brien's in Transporter Room 4. I thought that was very strange. But anyway, Picard calls for the transporter to beam aboard anything large enough to be a humanoid adult. And this may be a nitpick here, but I just don't get it. If the sensors says that there are no life forms on this escape pod, then what does a transporter lock onto? It should also say there's nothing to get.
I think you're correct in that. I Also, I'm gonna be really nitpicky and question the idea of having security there, because the idea of so we've met the James Cromwell character, and he looks like human-ish. So we're making a lot of assumptions about the fact you're going to beam on board someone that's human-ish. But for all you know, it's going to be like, a two-ton rhino man that's going to come out and, beat O'Brien up. So the idea of having only two security guards there, and whereas this guy can take, the phaser hits, I always find it quite naive. But, yeah, I don't know what it means to, send the transporter beam over there, poke around the escape pod and see what there is. I think it would have been more realistic just to beam the escape pod, the entirety of the escape pod into the, onto the Enterprise. I think that's probably what they would have wanted to have done, but probably didn't have the money.
Yeah. I mean, they were going to beam the entire drive section into the cargo bay. So.
Now, let me ask a question. With regards to this particular guy, what are your thoughts on him? Because whenever I think back to this episode, and I think this is going to come out extremely harsh, but I always think about this guy as being a bit of a more a rougher version of O'Connor, and for whatever reason I've got those two connected in my mind. Am I completely wrong here?
I don't know about completely wrong. I don't really see O'Connor in him. Since we all know that we do two episodes at a time, we're going to be reviewing The High Ground here, and that will come out next week. But actually, I kind of thought him, Rogar Danar, and Kiro Finn are pretty much the same people. That, by nature, they're very soft and gentle. They're gentle people, but when push comes to shove, they'll do what they have to do to, gain their objective, which in one really is both of them just want freedom. So it's interesting that these episodes are pretty much the same back to back, but our solution to these episodes are different. If that makes sense. Simon, how about you?
I really don't like Captain O'Connor. I don't like him as a character, but I find myself liking Rogar Danar. So I can see where you're coming from, James, why you see that there are similarities, but I much prefer the Danar character. Some of his interactions with the crew later on in this episode I really quite like and enjoy, which I didn't do at all with O'Connor.
I think this dude in this episode is he's slightly melodramatic in how he talks to people. In particular, I think when he's talking to Troy, and you don't go down this route fully, but there are certainly hints, at least, of him trying to chat her up, or at least have fun as he is talking. That's the thing that I start thinking. Well, would this dude that spent, I don't know how long he's supposed to have spent in prison, but would he really be in that frame of mind? So that's, I think, the overly dramatic the discussions is probably what I'm latching onto here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but like I said, the similarities between this and The High Ground, I mean, if Rogar Danar had the dimensional inverter, these episodes would literally be almost identical.
I mean, Simon's not looped in on the next one, but I'm actually very surprised that they put these two back to back. I'm surprised, and actually I'd go as far as saying I think it hurts The High Ground in my mind. We'll find out next week, but I'm not as big a fan of The Higher Ground, and I think that it's they've got enough stuff coming around that's varied in the coming weeks, and they could have easily put something else in between these two, and I think it would have done the series a bit more, but it would have smoothed the series over more fully.
Right, they should have done the next one a little bit later, like you say. Okay, so we have another example how phaser settings are just not good enough. Bring him in, Mr. O'Brien. Which O'Brien does, but Danar has a weapon that the transport detects and deactivates. So, when Danar transports aboard and he points his weapon his now dead weapon at one of at the security staff, they fire on him. Do you think maybe they needed to? I mean, why did they have to phaser him? He can't do anything with the weapon. And they don't know how strong he is at this point. Why not just do a standoff?
If they don't fire at him, then he won't attack them, because we later learn that he only attacks to defend himself. So it's kind of a plot requirement for them to fire first.
Makes sense. Yeah, that is it. Because the only thing the phaser does is piss him off. So he half destroys the transporter room. Oh, that was funny with the O'Brien. He got taken out pretty quick, but he came back around and tried to fire on him, but he got a phaser blast to his shoulder.
I think it's partly to show that he can withstand this multiple phaser hits, where normal people like O'Brien, one hit will take you out.
Mm. Yeah, it's only Riker and Worf that can take him down. And of course, that is after Riker got tossed around a bit.
I think it's noteworthy, the kind of the elongated scene. I think the action is, you know, the action is perfectly fine. It's not the best action in the world, of course, but it's fine. I think I was going to be flippant and say, well, if these dudes can't stop the guy with two phasers, then they're not exactly going to be able to stop the guy without two phasers. But I think it's fair to say that he might not have got annoyed with them had he not been phasered. It's, you know, this comes on the back of the action with the ship and everyone kind of running around. I think what we're supposed to take from this is that obviously this guy's he's a clever guy trying to, you know, he's a clever guy trying to evade capture. He's obviously been very well kind of, you know, programmed, I suppose is the word that they'll use later. And I don't think, you know, that there's no reports. They mentioned that he killed, I think, three people trying to escape, but he certainly doesn't kill anyone on the Enterprise. And I think I think we're expected to start believing, you know, this has been a sign of desperation rather than anything else. That certainly comes up with his conversations with Troy.
Yeah. You know, I guess we could go back. When Picard was touring the capital city, do you think Deanna should have been there?
Yep. I mean, I'm always a big advocate that Deanna should be a, can I give you more of a, ambassadorial role isn't the right word, but more of the diplomatic role, and the idea of going down to a planet to deal with people, even down to things that you might take for granted, you know, someone, a skilled diplomat, which I suppose Picard is to a certain extent, but a diplomat is always good to have around, even if nothing else, to keep you on toes, you know, regarding etiquette and making sure that things go as smoothly as possible. You certainly wouldn't leave someone like that behind if you were going, you know, you shouldn't be leaving that kind of person behind, in my opinion.
Yeah, because obviously Captain, he's hiding something. Okay, well, speaking of Deanna, she's taking a stroll through the ship, and all of a sudden she gets these waves of pain coming from Dainar, and she has to go investigate. And it's funny is that when she turns around and starts heading towards him, as she continued on, she started to walk faster and faster till she finally gets there, and he's okayed by now, but you know, she sensed that he was in pain. Do you like the back and forth between him and Deanna?
Yeah, it's kind of fun. He's full of contradictions when he's speaking to her, and Troy really doesn't like it when Dana calls her a mind control expert. I like that bit.
Yeah. Well, is she? I don't know about expert, but yeah, no, she can't control minds. But Doc.
Now, I mean, as I was alluding to at the top of the show, we've gone through a significant front end of action and running around and kind of, you know, to set up the show. And I know that this will often happen. As you move into, like, you know, what is the essence of the story, I think that the change of gear is a little too clunky, in my opinion. I think that the idea that, you know, Troy just walks by and then she rushes, you know, she happens to be hearing him, I suppose. Okay, she can do that. And then she runs into a dude that's in the brig to kind of chat and stuff. I think it's a little far-fetched, and you know, I don't think it happens it doesn't happen when, you know, Steve's in the bridge after a bar fight. So I'm not entirely sure why she would be running in now. So I can understand that. Yeah, I like the overall kind of proposition of this story probably better than how they managed to execute it. And I just think that the transition is, in my mind, this is a little clunky. I think if they could have found an easier and a smoother way to do it, I would have been less critical.
So if Picard had kind of ordered Troy to have a word with, find out more about him, might have worked better than just sensing that he was in pain.
I mean, fundamentally, all he has to do, right? All he has to do is, request asylum. You know, he only has to speak those words and state that, you know, he's been put in a place where he doesn't belong to be, and then, you know, people will start investigating, and you know, you could then use the idea. You know, technically, it's an internal matter, but it also reflects poorly upon the application, or at least it might influence the application to the Federation, which might then put the Prime Minister into a position where he's, you know, minded to allow the investigation, but so that they come across well, so that they don't come across as kind of, you know, too secretive, but at the same time he knows that there might be a secret they uncover. So there might have been a bit of tension on his side. So I would have preferred that kind of route than just, you know, because throughout this, right, I think Picard's slightly relegated. It's Troy and then to a lesser extent Data who come along and are this person's advocates. I think that Picard seems to be somewhat out of this. He had Troy not been there, had she not walked past, it sounds to me like he would potentially happily hand this person over and then walked off. And I'd rather there be a kind of like an active pursuit of the truth rather than, you know, people having stumbled across it because they happened to be walking down the corridor at the right time.
Hmm. Well, you know, you were saying that they shift gears a little too quickly, but I just thought that it was probably a couple hours between the capture and her walking down the corridor because he was asleep. I mean, he was having a bad nightmare at the time that she just stumbled upon that.
From an in-world universe perspective, I that's fine. I was merely commenting from the watching the episode perspective. I think that how the viewer has to get out of the mindset that we've just had a huge chase and into the mindset that we're going to have a discussion about how to handle war veterans. I just think that could have been done smoother.
Okay. All right. So it appears that the Ungosians alter the physical and psychological makeup of their soldiers by using a combination of, I believe she said, cryptobile, triclinidil, mackerel spindle, and a few other things that she didn't even recognize. So I wish they would go, you know, more into what it does for them. But do you guys remember any of that, like it increases their strength or their endurance? They can, you know, only need an hour of sleep a day, something to that extent. I don't remember any of that.
No, I mean, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think it's there.
Okay. All right. All right. So Data. Let's see here. Data goes to visit Daynar to talk about how they've both been programmed. And to talk about whether this programming could be undone, you know, if it could, why wouldn't they do it? Do you think Data really had a reason to go visit him for this programming bit? Kind of reminds me of Data and Jarek.
You mean from the defector?
Yeah. Yeah, Data has to visit the guy that just came aboard.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, in the defector, he kind of goes and looks at him in the... I mean, frankly, in the fact that there's, like, you know, it's an open question that's being discussed throughout the ship. So I don't think that that's, in my mind, too bad. In this episode, I think it's... I think they need to get Data as an external advocate into the, into the discussion. I think it's a little... to use a word that I've been using so far, I think it's a little clunky. I don't think that Data would naturally... what does Data have in common with this guy. I don't think a lot. I know that they said that I both programmed, but I don't think Data is, up until now, he's not really shown as a guy that is interested in this. He would have been interested in this story. Now, you know, had there been like a soldier on board, had there been like a Kira character, or maybe he had O'Brien's story being there with him having served in the military, then maybe. But I just don't think Data's the right guy.
Yeah. Simon, anything? You can jump.
Yeah, I think the programming similarities between Data and Daynar, it is a bit of a clunky way to get them into interact with each other, I think. Maybe if Data wanted to see who had outwitted him from the start of the episode, maybe that might have been a better avenue than the whole, oh, we've both been programmed, we're both alike kind of.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see where we are. And of course, I kind of thought the conference call with the Picard and the Prime Minister was pretty fascinating. You know, let's get some more information about what's going on. And he's only willing to give so much away before it treads on a matter of internal security. The age-old cry of the oppressor. So stay out of it.
I think Picard was a little harsh in terms of, you know, with the information that he probably would have had available at that point. But of course, we kind of know where the episode's going. Now, I have to say, I noticed this when I was watching. This is kind of pretty much exactly halfway through the episode. So it's a one criticism that I would kind of lay at it. I do think that the overall story is good, what they're trying to say. I think it's a little bit stretched, because I think what we go into after this is, you know, there's discussion at the end in particular about, about the right and wrongs about what they've done. But we very quickly fall into another chase scene as he escapes and he runs around the ship for, I think, around 10 minutes or so.
Right. Well, I mean, Picard's heard Daynar's side of the story and he's trying to get the other side, but the other side realizes their side is the bad side in the end, so we're not going to be talking about this. Just give our guy back and go away. Which is pretty much what Picard does in the end, but yeah.
I mean, actually, let me play devil's advocate and suggest that, I mean, I don't necessarily think that James Cromwell's character believes that he's, you know, quote unquote, the bad side. I think it's a pretty, you know, a pretty rubbish kind of scenario they've got themselves into. But I think that from their perspective, there was a war that they needed to fight. They have noticed that these guys aren't natural like fighters, so they had to have some type of intensive regime. So they had to have some type of intensive regime, even if it wasn't, genetically modifying superhumans or whatever. They needed to get these guys accustomed to that kind of way of life. And then when they came back, I suspect that you probably would have had a society that wouldn't embrace them coming back very well. And they did probably think that the easiest thing to do would be to, you know, allow them to settle elsewhere so that you effectively have parallel civilizations or parallel societies for a little while, maybe even on a temporary basis. And then when, you know, this is mentioned a little bit at the end, but then if there are then issues surrounding that regarding security or issues of lawlessness, then you almost have to start upping the ante and you have to put guards around their place. And very quickly, it sounded it was more that there was well intentions that very quickly escalated into something that looked like a prison, rather than they knew from day one that, you know, anyone that survived the war would be locked up because we frankly don't want them around.
Yeah, right.
And I think that as part of the discussion of the episode, I think is a, you know, it's a Star Trek-y, Star Trek-y story, right, to put across as to how do you handle this. And I do think you are right when you brought up, Lou, at the beginning, the parallels with Vietnam. And I think you really touched on is the idea of, when people go away and they come back, there are always issues about kind of like reintegrating them into society. And, you know, even just on a personal basis, how do you handle that? But I do think that, I think that in this episode, there is this thread of how do you integrate them into society when society itself would rather have forgotten the, you know, what was asked of them. And you mentioned about Vietnam and kind of, you know, you could potentially replace there any unpopular wars. But I think that they were going not just for the general how do you treat people that have that are servants and that need help, but I think that the idea of the unpopularity certainly comes into it. Or at least that's what I took out of it. Took out of this episode.
Okay. All right, Simon, anything to add?
I'm just wondering if there maybe there's a parallel with the kind of the American detention centers where was it Guantanamo Bay, where they held people that the society would, well, it was kind of for a different reason, but that they thought they couldn't integrate with the rest of the population.
No, Guantanamo Bay is actually where they believe enemy combatants, not prisoners of war. They're still the enemy that, or the potential enemy, and quite frankly, I don't agree with the locking someone up because they might be a potential threat. Not necessarily that they've done anything wrong, but there are some there that have tried things and they belong there. But, I mean, this society, they're locking up their own veterans because they've altered their molecular structure to make them better soldiers. But because they're better soldiers, they can't live in the society because their programming clicks in whenever something happens to one of them and they just go way overboard.
I mean, although that's how you phrase the issue at hand within the Star Trek sci-fi, you know, concept. Mm. You don't need any of that. You just say that, you know, a soldier's gone away. He's been involved in war. He comes back, and adapting to normal day-to-day life after coming back is hard. And certainly, if people have served on, you know, on the front line or in active duty, it's very hard, and it's, you know, anything, you know, from, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder to just not feeling that you belong anymore are issues that, you know, people, I think what the episode is trying to do is put out there and say, okay, to what extent does society need to do more to make sure that this is addressed? And I think, mm-hmm. you handle it in this particular sci-fi case as being these, you know, these people that have been modified, but all that modified, that's just code for, you know, you're now accustomed to this way of life. And I think that I certainly don't think that just because we don't modify our soldiers and send them off to fight, that doesn't allow us to get out of the idea that when they come back they might require special attention. Let me ask you, Simon, what's your take on the dude breaking out of the transporter beam?
Oh, I've got something I want to mention just before we move on to that bit.
Okay, go on then.
Data, in one of the conversations Data has with Daynar, he mentions that he's not programmed to kill. And I just wondered what people thought of that. Because being a Starfleet officer, surely he's going to come up against situations where he needs to kill for various reasons. How did he cope with, say, when the Dominion War? He must have been in situations where he would needed to kill. Maybe does Data follow Asimov's laws? Is he allowed to kill a human? I just wondered what people's thoughts were on that.
No, actually, I think so. That's interesting. I suppose the first thing I'd say is that, was he saying that he wasn't, you know, programmed to kill? In the sense, so I read that as being that his primary function wasn't as a killer. So in the as opposed to the soldier who was being kind of put together to kill. But I do think it is an interesting question that I don't think gets really addressed as to what is, you know, what is, for want of a better word, I think they refer to it every now and again as you know, Data's ethical subroutines.
Yeah.
So what are the rules of engagement? And you mentioned kind of Asimov's, kind of like, you know, Asimov's three laws of robotics. I would imagine that Data would have a similar approach. I don't think that, you know, Asimov's ones are pretty, you know, that they're very kind of hard line that doesn't allow the, individual in question to harm. I don't think, you know, I never got the impression that Data was always firing, like, you know, a stun phaser or would refuse to take orders if he was having to fire the torpedoes. So I always got the impression that with Data, it's more of a, you know, the ethical subroutines effectively implanted a kind of like a quote-unquote decent human moral standing kind of a view of the world.
But yet he joined a paramilitaristic organization. And, you know, I'm thinking of a future episode. I mean, he's in a military organization. If he's not prepared to kill, he doesn't belong there. And then I kept thinking of, you know, stop, 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 bam! He, you know, crushed this Borg's neck in a future episode. So Data can kill. He just doesn't do it indiscriminately like Daynar. He doesn't do it indiscriminately like they believe Daynar does. So we have no choice but to return the prisoner, or should I say victim, to Angoja. Another transport ship arrives, and we initiate a flawless transport. No. We learned something about transporter technology today. If you want to prevent being beamed out, all you've got to do is hold your hands up, maybe out, show your palm out, and you can block the transport. I personally had no idea that was possible.
Sounds okay. like a design to me.
Simon, say that again.
Sounds like a design flaw on the transporter. It's very dangerous if you just need to put your hands out and it causes a massive explosion.
And you can get away with it too. Doc?
Okay, in my notes regarding the transporter, now, I think there are a couple of people that can't be transported. I seem to recall that there's another couple, I think maybe in Deep Space Nine, that have ways of blocking transporters. I can't remember whether that's like an internal thing or whether it's kind of like, you know, transporter dampeners or whatever. But again, I personally thought this was the stupidest idea I've ever seen. I have that in my notes, and I really didn't like the idea of someone kind of like, you know, with positive mental attitude being able to get out of a transporter beam, because it didn't make sense.
Well, it does in a sense, because he can block sensors from detecting life signs. So he can obviously deflect radiation waves, and my guess is it's the same with the transporter. But it's a good thing he did, because, again, we get another really excellent cat-and-mouse game. Because I thought the his all-over-the-ship thing makes Worf look like an idiot.
Yeah,
until the end.
No, sure. And the actual, you know, the actual scene is, I did note, I think it's around 10 minutes or so as he escapes and he runs around and they have debates about stuff, about, you know, where he's heading and, you know, discussion points and the like. I think it works well. I think the fact that it's so unusual in Star Trek is making me sit here thinking, as I mentioned already, maybe they're missing the B plot. Which perhaps is unfair. You know, maybe I shouldn't be judging this episode by how different it is to other episodes. I do think that the guy in question is very, very... Maybe he's a little too good as an escape artist. I think that sometimes, you know, the numbers of times he double bluffs is a little bit, a little bit silly. And in particular, mm-hmm. because he kind of gets... you know, he introduces more than one bluff, and they go, you know, if he has like an N state bluff, they always go to N minus one and go, oh, you know, we nearly had him. So I don't know. I think that he's a little bit too good, and, well, frankly, he's very well. He's kind of like he's a scripted villain rather than what a real villain would be getting up to, which is, it is what it is.
He does think our characters a bit weak because they've been to Starfleet Academy. They know all the functions of the ship, whereas he's just been altered and happens to and somehow knows exactly which how to reroute power and all the other things that he does. It's not too bad at the start of the episode. That's a bit more believable. But this section, it's a bit hard to follow to believe that he's capable of everything that they portray him as able to do.
Right.
Yeah, because I mean, at the beginning, it's like space combat, and, you know, space combat is space combat. Whereas now, it's is he able to handle the internal workings of a starship that uses technology he is not familiar with? And I think that is that is a big step. I mean, having said that, by the way, I like, you know, I like where they go with this, frankly. I like the fact that, you know, there's an invasion, you learn a little bit about maybe this guy should be on the run for a legitimate reason, and then he escapes. And actually, in particular, I do like the climax of this episode. I think it's... I know this is always a weak statement to make, and it's always a bit of a cop-out, but it's very Star Trek-y how they end it.
Yes.
In a sense that, you know, I'm sure everyone that likes Star Trek and loves it knows what I mean, but you can't imagine another episode of another TV series ending it in this way.
What was that?
Okay, sorry about that.
That sounded like an elephant. So here we are in the cat and mouse game, and a couple of things I noticed is that, number one, you were saying that you thought he was made to be overly intelligent to be able to escape, but I thought, I don't know how it's any different than anyone else who escapes on the Enterprise. It's a common theme. But here's another thing. How about the lowly security guard who's standing in the on deck 36 and gets, you know, knocked out quickly because he's not looking the right way? And Danar is able to take his hand, pop it on his communicator, and say, drop force field on deck 36. Do you think maybe a lowly security guard should be able to say, drop force field?
No. I thought it was funny, and it kind of reminds me about, they have a very similar scene in Star Wars, right? When they're trying to escape, and the Han Solo gets on the comm and goes, oh yeah, no, we had some problems, but it's okay now. And I just would have imagined him, you know, saying, drop force field on section 15 or whatever. And they went, Steve, is that you?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. No voice recognition in the 24th century? No, that's not you. And even if it was, how do they know he's not being held captive? You shouldn't drop the force field until, you know, everybody can gang up on him. But not only can he drop the force field, he is so smart, he's able to bypass ship functions. I guess Data did say he was very extremely adept. It looks like he's heading for Shuttle Bay 2, but Data... Now, this is where you're right. The double-double-double bluff-double-bluff-bluff-double-bluff comes into effect, because Data's figuring, no, he can't actually be heading for Shuttle Bay 2. Or, yes, Shuttle Bay... Was it Shuttle Bay 2 that they thought he was heading for? But Data says he highly doubts it and said he's probably heading to the cargo bay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or was it the other way around? Did they believe he was originally heading for the cargo bay? But
I think he was on his way up. They were suggesting he was going to cargo bay too, but then Data said, no, I don't think he is. I think he's trying to make us believe that he is. And then he ended up in the cargo bay, at which point Riker then said, well, maybe he's trying to go out through, like, you know, the hatch to get to cargo bay 2 through, you know, to evade security.
Bay 2, that's right. So from the outside. From that.
But I don't know what they were, it was a lot of a back and forth.
So let's say he did that. He's in a pressure suit. He's on the outside of the ship, and he gets to Shuttle Bay 2 from the outside. Is there like a little button on the outside that you can press and the doors open? Or maybe his superhumanoid strength can force the doors open.
Well, this is one of the things. You're making a lot of assumptions, right? That well, if one were to go through the outside to get to Shuttle Bay 2, I mean, maybe that's possible, maybe it's not. I would imagine that it's not possible. Because,
no, I wouldn't think so either.
You know, how many times do you need access through the exterior? It just doesn't make a huge amount of sense.
No. Unless there's a single door that you can open up and that we don't ever see. Okay, so the phasers on this episode really are phenomenal, if you think about them. You know, it overloads subsystems, knocks out the external sensors, even powers a transporter.
Yeah, true.
And the transporter has a slot, so you can plug in your phaser.
Yeah,
it's like saying that, you know, oh, I need a getaway car, but I don't have any petrol. Don't worry, I've got a shotgun. Bang, bang, bang. I mean, can you power a car with a shotgun? I don't know why you'd expect to be able to power a transporter with a phaser.
Yeah, right. So, unfortunately, Danar uses the transporter with the phaser power to beam aboard the Angosian police shuttle, where now he gets to terrorize the village. So, and of course, the Prime Minister is begging for help. Please, we don't know what to do with them. That's why we created them. Okay, we'll beam down and take care of them. Or he didn't say we'll take care of this, but we'll be on our way. And this time, he brings Deanna. A little late, but he brings Deanna. Now, do you believe Worf should have been personally responsible for the captain's safety? I mean, he's been top notch up to this point. So, I mean, right? Because you know he owes the captain that.
Well, I mean, going down as chief of security, isn't he always implicitly responsible for his safety? I mean, so he always is, but he's clearly not having a good day at the office today.
Well, normally Picard wouldn't beam down. It's usually Riker, but would Worf be personally responsible for Riker?
He's chief of security. It's his job.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta wonder, at the end of the day, when the Enterprise warps off after this is all over, does Picard bring Worf into his ready room and say, here, we need to talk about your performance today. It wasn't very honorable. Well, it was honorable, but you weren't very effective.
I'm sure he gets his pay docked for this week.
No replicator rations, holodeck, you know, Baltic warriors he gets to kill or anything for a week.
He's spending far too much time in the holodeck, combating Skeletor and whatnot.
Right. Okay. All right, so here we are down to the end. You know, the prisoners escape. They're terrorizing the village, like I said, and they get to the capital city where about six or eight of them end up inside this room, and the Prime Minister has got several weapons drawn on him. He's, Captain, do something. You're absolutely right. I need to do something. Picard Enterprise, four to beam up. But the good thing he offers Narok, I believe his name was, Federation assistance in reprogramming their soldiers. But he's not going to be interfering with the development of the Angosian society, and in his own words, it would develop very quickly.
Now, I have to say that I think that I have a couple of problems with how it ends, because I think it ends a little bit too smug for its own good. But I do like fundamentally where they're going with this, because a lot of stuff that we discussed about, you know, soldiers and how they kind of get readapt after service and stuff, you know, we've done, and this is where in the episode, kind of like our protagonists make that statement to the main dude of the show that, you know, doesn't hold that view yet, at least. I have to say, I think that it's a little bit kind of over-egged, and in particular with the guys that get sent down. I think it's not just Picard that makes the speech. And frankly, I think it's better when Picard's the guy making the speech. It's Picard and Troy and several others that are kind of like acting as a chorus here to really kind of, you know, really slap this dude down, which I think is a little bit unfair. I also think that it's a little bit harsh, right, to start discussions in anything at gunpoint. That's not generally the way you want to kind of start off on the front foot. But, you know, you can see where they're coming from. I think that it's a little harsh as well that Picard kind of straight away says, well, you're not going to get your Federation membership approved. I can tell you that. And I'm going to now beam you away. But on the plus side, you know, away from this little slight smug kind of a slap down, I love the fact that you leave and you don't know which way they're going. So you don't know whether or not, you know, you're given the impression that Picard beams away, and then these two realize the errors of their extremists' views on this particular issue or the opposite sides, and they sit down and have a nice discussion and so on. And that's what you're expected. But because they leave it open, you know, for all you know, that the rebels have already started executing people and they're going after their women and children. So perhaps they should have had a little bit better closure. But I do like the fact that it's slightly left open.
Well, I think it's because the Prime Minister pissed Picard off with saying this is not your concern. And, you're absolutely right. This is not my concern. Good luck. So do we have anything else before we go into final thoughts?
I mean, not for me, and I appreciate that I've been blabbering more than usual this week.
I wouldn't have it any other way. Simon?
I think move on to final thoughts.
Well, actually, so before we do, very small tangent. Obviously, I know James Cromwell as Zephyrin Cochrane. I know that he has also been in other episodes, and I know as well, you know, once he was Zephyrin Cochrane, I know that people then realize that he was in these episodes and also a couple of others. I think Birthright he's in as well. But I find the character that he plays to be almost completely anonymous. And I actually also think that the performance he gives in First Contact is, you know, I think it's pretty fantastic. And in this episode, it's very, very, very flat, which, you know, it's obviously the same dude. So it's just a testament to how, I suppose, how well written he is in First Contact and how, like, how underused maybe he is in this episode. And when I was talking a little bit earlier about maybe you could have actually had this be more led from a Picard versus the PM's perspective and have them have kind of, you know, the dance of trying to reach the truth. You know, you certainly had a huge talent here in James Cromwell that I think was not used as much as it could otherwise have been.
Right, because he looks totally different from this episode and to First Contact.
Yeah, astonishingly so. I think he looks better in First Contact, though. I know he's older,
very much,
but he's kind of got a... I don't quite know what it is, but he looks well.
He looks like he has a worn down look in First Contact.
Whereas
he's just
where he is
old and doesn't give a crap no more.
No, but sure. But I think here he looks exactly the same, but just made up to not look like that. In a way, I don't know if that's a good way of describing it. But I find him it's very weird his look in this episode.
Is it just a moustache? Mm.
And the moustache. I'm not the biggest fan of his moustache.
No. Okay.
It's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode, and we'll give it a score between 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. So if I were to go first, I have to say I do like the... I like what they're trying to do with this episode. I think that the execution is not quite as, you know, not quite as polished as it should be. I think I've said a lot so far, but let me just come in with that, you know, I think overall that it's, they attempted to do a better episode than they managed to get on screen. I think it, in the end, in my mind, it comes in around the middle. I score it a 3 out of 5. It's certainly not a, you know, not a disaster, but I think they had grander plans in my mind, and had there been a, you know, a few minor tweaks, I think this would have been a good standout episode, because there's certainly enough there, and also, as I've just mentioned, there's enough talent that it was booked for this show as well. So a slight missed opportunity in my mind, but still, it's still a solid episode of Star Trek. Hey, Simon.
I like this episode. I think there are a few bits in the middle where Daynar outwits the Enterprise a bit too easily, but I think we've got a good balance of action and good old-fashioned Star Trek morals. Simply exist is not enough. That's kind of Star Trek at its core, I think. So I'm going to go with a 4 out of 5.
Okay. Then I'll go last. I like it. It's a good... I think it's a fairly good story, and I love the cat and mouse scenes. You know, I'm kind of amazed at the ineptness of the Enterprise crew. I strongly suggest lots of tactical training and do it very soon, because they should have been able to stop him some way. Tighter controls, maybe. We'll see. They'll have to rebuild some systems first, but anyway. The Federation will help the Angosian government. That is assuming they survive the night, and they will help reprogram their soldiers. Again, I like the story. I do kind of like Rogar Daynar. I think he must have had some Klingon blood, but it might have been the better stuff than what Worf has. I'm not sure. It's a pretty complicated matter concerning secrets of state and the society's treatment of their veterans. And like I said earlier, the analogy is glaring. It may be a little different, but it's still there. I'd say until they become members of the Federation, you know, how far should we become involved with their society? I suppose not at all. I think Picard probably was just trying to, maybe show off our Federation powers, and it overtook him faster, or just said it overtook him to begin with. But, and like Picard says, they're going to survive because they're going to want to survive. And since it takes 7 years to join the Federation, as we find out later in DS9, they have a very, very long road ahead. So I like the action. Not one of the best. Not the middle of the road either. So I agree with Simon. I think this is a 4 out of 5. So I will go with a 4. Okay. James doesn't like 3.5s, or else he probably would have given it that.
That is not true. That is not true. And hey, I'm Mr. Grumpy this week, so that's good. Because I do think that I think pretty much in 90% of the episodes, Lou, I end up rating above you, even if it's the half point here and there. And you know, you'll say, "Oh, I think it's 3.5. It's nearly a 4," and I'll say, "Well, it's a 4 for me because I don't round down." So it's good at least that you're going to be catching up in terms of average scores. And I suspect,
now I figured out your secret.
Okay, I think you're also going to probably catch up next week as well. So perhaps
we'll see. So Simon, I want to thank you for coming on tonight, and hopefully we can get you on again. I can't bring up the guest list at this point because I don't have Microsoft Office installed. It's a story for another day. But as soon as I do, I will. Obviously, you know, if there's something you may want in the future, just when season 4 comes up, just take a look and grab something.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, I'd like to come back for something in season 4. I'll have to have a look at what episodes there are and choose one.
There you go. Yeah, we'll have it. We'll have the schedule, or as James calls it, the schedule.
I don't call it this. The what?
Schedule.
I do. Actually, by the way, it's not even an English thing. I do use the word schedule now, and I know that there was a point in my life where I changed from schedule to schedule, and it's just one of those things. I'm one of the very few people I've ever come across that uses the soft H in that word, or the soft C in that word.
That's fascinating. Someday he may get tired of taking this abuse from me, but
never.
It won't be soon. All right.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation. Radical terrorists attack and kidnap Dr. Crusher.
This is a war for independence.
You are killing innocent people.
Strike without warning.
They are moving interdimensionally.
Kill without mercy.
Explosive charge on the main warp chamber.
And are declaring war on the Enterprise on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Okay, well, you know, once again, thank you for Simon for joining us this week. Thank you for listening. Please join us next week as we review the next episode of Star Trek Next Generation, which is The High Ground. And we look forward to having Data Logan on for that. So, until then, I'm Jim from London.
I'm Simon from York.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Thank you for downloading, and stick around for the forums. We'll be there in just a little bit. Thank you, Simon, again for coming on with us. And good night.
Good night.
Blooper. Well, good to have you on, Simon. So why don't you go ahead and jump the synopsis.
Let's see what we've got. The synopsis for tonight's episode is... This is not the right synopsis.
Wait.
Nope, it's not the right synopsis.
Oh, jeez.
I know I mentioned that episode, but I didn't think we were discussing it.
We're not. I hit the wrong one. Oh, Lord. Okay. See, the hurrier you go, the behinder you get.
That's a good saying.
Yeah. It's true, though. Oh, jeez, guys, I'm sorry. If you don't mind, let me just go ahead and find it and get it done, or do it, okay? Because it'd take longer to type. See, that my whole browser is screwed because I don't have my links that I have right in front of me usually. The Hunted. So, when you were introducing it, let me see here. I got a feeling this... The Hunted. Good, I did say that. Okay. Alright, and since I screwed up the script for today, I'm going to have to read it because it's just too long to type. Well, that's not too long, but it's all... never mind. Alright, it is now time to go into our forum feedback. And for this week, we're going to start with the enemy. And the enemy starts with Data Logan, who we will have on next week as our guest for the High Ground. Looking forward to that, aren't you, James?
I am very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be a very quick episode, say about 40 minutes or so.
Yeah, apparently true. Yeah,
maybe, maybe not. I don't know. He says, I think it has been very consistent throughout Star Trek that no one from either side of the neutral zone is allowed to enter the zone. Just because Tomalak is a bit brazen with his crossings in this episode does not mean that all other references are wrong. The fact that the neutral zone is off limits to both sides was established from the very beginning in TOS Balance of Terror, and seen in many episodes including TNG's Contagion and The Defector. The demilitarized zone, contrary to the neutral zone, is allowed to have beings inside it and even trade across it as long as they don't carry weapons. There are very different types of zones. There is a brief reference in later TNG episode Reunification Part 2 that implies that the Romulans in this episode were setting up for the action scene in that later episode. It's the only other reference we get in the series of what possibly may have been going on here. While an, quote, everyday, end quote, person could not be ordered to participate in a medical procedure, someone in the military could very much be legally obliged to follow such an order. Remember, when beings enter military life, they sign over some of their rights, including the right not to endanger themselves or do things they don't want to do. If there is a reasonable military, strategic, or political need for the action, it could be ordered onto the service member against their reservations. I think Worf was right, saying that he didn't want to do the medical procedure, but would if ordered. And I really do feel that Picard should have ordered it. Then again, as soon as a Romulan stated that he didn't want any of Worf's material inside his body, the whole question should have become moot. Medical ethics would prevent any doctor from forcing a procedure on an unwilling patient who has not given up the right of refusal by joining the applicable military. The Romulan was not a Starfleet officer. He could not be ordered by Starfleet superior to accept the procedure like Worf could be. Of course, the Romulan may have been ordered by Tomalak to accept the procedure, assuming the military has the same concept of loss of some rights of freedom of their service members. Maybe Picard and Tomalak should have talked more about this. You know, another thing I had thought of after we even did The Defector, when I said, now Dr. Crusher's had two Romulans on board the ship and couldn't save either one of them. I was just thinking, since she's, you know, the Romulans obviously turned around and left Jarak in Federation hands. I'm curious why she didn't, like, get some of his rival zones. Because I would assume that if Worf is the only one who has compatible rival zones to help the Romulan, I would imagine the Romulan is the only one who would have acceptable rival zones to help Worf. So someday, if Worf ever needed them, no one on the ship could give it to him except the Romulans. So do you think I'm sure Wesley has plenty of rival zones that would be compatible, but if the Romulan was the only one that could give Worf the rival zones in a future, maybe he paralyzes himself, hurts himself, and he needs rival zones. Do you think Crusher would have been ethically able to take some from the Romulan to store?
No, I don't think I don't think that's allowed. So I don't think they would be allowed to have done that, or Crusher would have been allowed to keep it. I mean, I think that there was a, certainly there was a scandal in the UK a little while ago where, after people had died, not all of the, not all of the body was returned to the, to the, to the appropriate people for burial, etc. And I think in some cases it even include some children that had died prematurely, and they then basically 5 years later wrote and said, look, we've still got the X, Y, or Z. For whatever reason, I don't think this was body parts in terms of the externals, but it was still it was stuff that was taken from the body, and I don't think that went down extremely poorly. So I don't think it's I don't think doctors are allowed to keep the bits just because they think they might be useful later.
Okay,
maybe Pulaski would have done that. No, I'm just hassling about Pulaski. I should maybe learn to it.
Perhaps Endicore's next, and this would be 4 now, I believe, and maybe someday we might find out who Endicore is.
Yep, sure. And so, is this the first episode to have 3 concurrent storylines? Whether it is or not, it's a major improvement over the earlier seasons, where a single story would have to be painfully stretched out to fill the entire 45 minutes. At the same time, I like how all the stories in this episode were perfectly intertwined, unlike during the latter seasons, where it seemed like the writers were picking the A and B subplots out of a hat. First, we have Geordi stranded on the planet. This plotline is great because it's not a typical Geordi story. The contrast between the Federation and the Romulan cultures was definitely the highlight of this episode. Although Geordi did act really naive, setting aside your differences and working with your enemy is the essence of Trek. Moreover, I really liked that Golondan Core was a very inhospitable world. In later Trek, our heroes always get to beam down to some green meadow under sunny skies, just because the producers were lazy and they went to film outside in California. I found this hostile, dangerous planet far more immersive, even though it was just a set on some soundstage. Now, actually, let me just take a pause here. Kind of ironically, they probably ended up going to these nicer locations later because they happened to have more budget later. It's very likely that when you do have the soundstage, whether it's here or when you end up on the Ferengi last outpost and all of that stuff, you're using the soundstage just probably because that's cheaper rather than bussing people out into the middle of somewhere in California. But no, certainly point taken. Fashioning a fair of climbing tools with his phasers, though, was a clever non-technobabble solution. Geordi using his phasers at all also emphasized the difference with the Romulan, who only used his disruptor to take him as prisoner. Similarly, actually seeing Geordi vision was great, because soon the writers will all but forget about it. Next, we have Worf and the dying Romulan. Although the setup of a Romulan requiring a transfusion from a Klingon rather than a Vulcan was contrived, Worf's moral dilemma was so well executed that it didn't matter. Actually, just going off the script here, that I think that's completely the case. I really didn't care whether it was logically consistent that Worf was the person here. Whether it makes sense or not, I didn't care. It was very well done, as is mentioned in the comment. Additionally, TNG Romulans already differed from the Vulcans by having those silly forehead ridges, so they may have had other physiological differences. I also really enjoyed your speculation regarding Dr. Crusher, her complete medical incompetence and attempts to cover it up. Despite returning only for half a season ago, she is quickly becoming my least favourite character during this rewatch. There will definitely be more to say about this later. Finally, there's Picard confronting Tomalak, an adversary worthy enough to be a recurring character. The standoff did not disappoint. Speaking of which, given how many times it happened, I was under the impression that either side could enter the neutral zone, but they were only prohibited from claiming planets and building star bases in that region. This is the interpretation would have given Tomalak firmer ground to build in his case. All three parts work and fit perfectly together in this episode, and while not the absolute best, it's definitely my top 20 TNG episodes and deserves a 5 out of 5. So thank you very much, Indycore, on that. I'm just thinking whether it's in my top 20. I think it'll probably, I mean, certainly going to be in like a top 50. I don't know. Lou, this entire exercise of us chatting every week to discuss Star Trek is really my way of clearing up once and for all which are my favorite episodes. So when we finish, I hope that you have some statistics to hand over and you can give me the list of all my 5-star episodes, and that will be it.
Oh, yeah.
And it will be a public service. And I thank you in advance.
No problem. Yeah. I mean, I have them all listed here for season 1, 2, and 3. And all I need to do is make up one Excel spreadsheet page that would list them all, and I could sort them any way I wish and come up with the category of your 5s, your 4s, 3s, 2s, 1 for both of us, really. So yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's see. The next one will be Kieran McDuff. Kieran McDuff. He didn't sound like that, guys. I'm sorry. I think this is another of those episodes where I enjoyed the podcast more than the actual episode. Deja vu. Doesn't he say this in another one?
Yeah, I think it has been mentioned before.
So we're not repeating the forum feedback for the wrong show.
No, not at all. We haven't read this one.
Okay.
you'll merely be taking a compliment twice.
Thank you again. For instance, your discussion about what would you do in Worf's position was great. The example you gave was 9/11. Would you help them? Well, yes, I would. I definitely wouldn't suggest that all Muslims are the same in their extremist as their extremist element. So even if the extremist element were responsible for the death of my parents, I wouldn't see them as the same thing. Okay, so setting aside the difference between Muslims and their extremist element, would I help save the life of an extremist? Well, amusingly, if the extremists refused to take my blood to help them stay alive, then I'd probably be more inclined to do it just to piss them off. Especially if keeping them alive was of use to us and might save other lives further down the road. There's something quite appealing to me about doing something to mess with the extremist views. I wonder what he does to scam telemarketers that call him up. Tell him how many pounds he's won if all he needs to do is just give him their credit card number. Okay, so as for the episode itself, I don't know about the original plan to have Geordi stranded with Troy. Wow, that would have been awful. At least what they ended up with was a good example of how spending time with your enemy might make you realize how similar you actually are. Stranding Geordi with Troy, what would that have achieved? I don't think it would have been anywhere near as good as an episode if they had done that. Then again, there are a lot of holes. Not sending Data doesn't make any sense if they're only going down for a few minutes. Clearly, the tricorders, communicators, and transport buffers all work for a reasonable length of time, as does Geordi's visor. So surely Data would have been the same. Or are we saying these other devices were all going to be damaged to the point where they'd throw them away? Well, if that's the case, how many visors does Geordi have? Does he have several visors? I always got the impression he had only one. That's surely something you wouldn't want to get damaged any more than Data. That is a good point, you know. We may only have one Data, but he's only got one visor. So my guess is, I mean, they seem to get different. I believe in a future episode, he says he's worn different visors along the way, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, in the first season, he had a silver visor, and now he's moved on to the gold visor. Mm. So aesthetically, it has been upgraded. But now that, you know, I've really not considered this, and now that it's been noted, I'm just wondering whether or not Geordi goes into a sock drawer in his quarters, and there's 50 visors that have been thrown down. In the same way, anyone that wears glasses, you generally get through glasses, and you can have a couple of pairs at any given time.
Yeah, I have 3 pairs. They're all in my car because they're only for driving. But sometimes I take it out of the car and then I lose it, and I've got extras. So I mean, it'd be curious how many visors he's lost over time. Oh, that's funny. He wakes up in the morning, goes to his drawer, opens up the drawer, and just kind of Stevie Wonder feels around for some visors and just grabs one and puts it on. So he doesn't know what visor he's wearing from each day. All right. Now, Kieran goes on to say at least the phasers last long enough to make steps and cook toasties. Sorry, grilled cheese sandwiches. Toasties, huh? Is that what you guys call it?
Yeah. I mean, anything that is a toasted sandwich, you can call a toasty.
Okay.
You don't necessarily have to say it has to be cheese or cheese and tomato or cheese and ham, but, you know, a toasty is just a cheese sandwich, or a toasted sandwich. Typically cheese, because cheese melts, right? And then it makes everything great.
Oh, yeah.
But I assume it works with, you know, other stuff.
I've always said it's not easy being cheesy. Okay. Then there's a whole concept that somehow Worf is compatible with the Romulan, but the Vulcans are ruled out. Yeah, I'm not buying that one. The Vulcans would be their best hope, without a doubt. For one thing, you have to look at the color of their blood. Our blood is red, as are Klingons. Well, except for Star Trek IV, of course, because then they were purple, I believe. But the Vulcans, and therefore Romulans, are green. That's how different they are. They're copper-based, while we are iron-based. I can only assume the Klingons are the same. But, see, the thing, I don't know about the ribosomes, though. Obviously, it's like plasma, in a sense. It's a scope, or part of the blood. Not necessarily the coloring factor, is it?
Well, I mean, I'm just about to, you know, I don't know, but I'm about to just ask out to the general, you know, general intelligence of our listeners. I thought that the only thing that in our blood was iron-based was the hemoglobin, which I suppose, you know, is what kind of why we are kind of red-blooded. And that's not the entirety of blood, certainly not. I thought that when you got plasma out, it was like a kind of clear liquid. But I might be completely wrong. I'm not a medical doctor.
No, me either. Okay. All right, so now I know it wasn't blood that was a problem, but blood is very fundamental here. If it's that different, I don't see how it would be possible for Worf to be compatible. But that would deny us a whole moral dilemma, so we're just expected to accept it. Back on the planet, Geordi assuming the neutrino signal was Wesley's idea makes no sense. I totally agree. Data should have been able to rhyme off a bunch of ideas for people to pick from. This happens in Star Trek a lot. Data says he can't think of anything. Someone suggests something and Data then confirms that it would work. I can only imagine the problem is that Data has no imagination and that's what you need for problem solving. Well, if that's the case, then Data is no better than the ship's computer, and we shouldn't waste time asking him for ideas. Except sometimes he comes up with his own ideas, in which case he's just written inconsistently. I guess we can't have Data being the guy who saves the day every time. Actually, the only time they cripple him with emotions, we lose the Enterprise D, so maybe there's something in it after all. Data Logan was nearly nailed. Data Logan was already nailed to the neutral zone demilitarized zone issue, so I won't go into those. Suffice to say, the neutral zone is an empty buffer. The demilitarized zone is an unarmed area. It does seem a bit lax at time, though. And this episode is one of those times. But I almost forgive these shortcomings because we get Tomalak from this episode. I was a big fan of Andreas Katsalas in Babylon 5. And I almost wish we'd got more of Tomalak in TNG because he seemed like a very interesting Romulan, like we could have dealt with a lot more. But then I'd argue we'd spent too much time on Klingons and not enough time on Romulans across the Star Trek series. Sadly, oh, yeah, see, you know, can you imagine how the latter years of DS9 would have been if Tomalak was the Romulan that was actually assigned to DS9 for the, you know, for the war?
I mean, that'd be interesting. I like the, I mean, am I crazy that the original woman either disappeared or, I didn't know what, I thought that the first Romulan that we had wasn't the Romulan that like later became like quasi regular for like two or three episodes, I mean, I'm always a big fan of having these like universes intertwine, right?
Mm-hmm.
In particular, I like that Worf goes over. I like that O'Brien goes over. So I would certainly be extremely happy to get Tomalak across.
Anyway, what do you mean by the female Romulan?
In DS9, there's a female Romulan that looks after this cloaking device.
Yes. She goes on to play Seska.
Does she?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's the same woman that plays Seska.
Ah, then in that case, she does change then. So someone else comes in later, right?
Yeah, she just disappears. I mean, yeah, that was interesting that she had to be on the bridge. She had to be the one to control the cloaking device. And then all of a sudden, she's gone and our own people take over. Okay. Well, anyway, let's continue. Sadly, Tomalak only turns up properly in one more episode, The Defector. And then twice more in events that don't actually take place, such as a hologram in the future and an alternate timeline that Q creates in All Good Things. So we have to make do with what we have. Well, I like the fact they brought Tomalak up for the last one, too. And oh, that was me saying that, by the way. Anyway, Pi, a strange name for a ship. I'd almost expect it to be more rounded if it was called Pi. Overall, I want to rate this episode highly. There's some interesting ideas throughout it, from moral dilemmas to getting to know your enemy through necessity. But there is really some annoying holes in this episode, and it takes away something from the storylines. They become a distraction, so rather than moving the story along, they get on your nerves, and you don't enjoy it as much. Enjoy the episode as much. Maybe that's just me. So he ends it with, my score for this episode has to be in the middle of the road, 3 out of 5. And hey, look who's back, Kieran McDuff. Why don't you read his follow-up?
Okay, to be taking it, a few points you made in feedback. First, don't worry about the timing on Booby Trap. Yes, it was rushed, but I know how difficult scheduling can be around the rest of what life throws at you. Hopefully next time life will be kind and give us some more time. Although I'm not sure I'll be able to make Tin Man, which is really frustrating as I'd love to catch up with Colin as well. The Scrubs explanation. A quick video will do. Suffice to say, Ken Jenkins played both Dr. Bob Kelso in Scrubs and Dr. Paul Stubbs. Did I say he played it in Stubbs or in Scrubs? He played Dr. Bob Kelso in Scrubs and Dr. Paul Stubbs in TNG's Evolution. And finally, the Borg in Enterprise. Yes, that is another point, and one I think they were trying to get at. However, Lou mentions the Hansons, and I'm not entirely sure on the timing. No doubt someone better on timelines can confirm this, but I think all incidents pretty much covered are converged to the same time. I think the Hansons may have encountered the Borg before the Enterprise-D, but it might have only been for a few years. Mm-hmm. It all depends on the age of 7. The Borg in Enterprise were always taken roughly 200 years to inform the Delta Quadrant Borg, so that more or less adds up. I don't think they were too specific, they merely hinted at. So all three could contribute to the Borg finally coming to find the Federation.
Mm.
And he mentioned this, I have no idea that was this discussed? Did we discuss the Borg in The Enemy? When does this happen? because we do our feedback, or when we record our feedback for the shows, we're always like, you know, 3 episodes behind, and my brain does not remember what we talked about when we were recording.
Well, what he's saying is that in your feedback part about Booby Trap, which would have been just before The Enemy. So in somewhere in Booby Trap, I mean, could we have really discussed 200 years?
So we're now recording this on The Hunted, and we're reviewing the feedback for The Enemy, which in The Enemy, there was feedback on Booby Trap where we discussed the book.
Oh,
wow.
Boy. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how we got into that. Okay, well, hey, thanks, Kieran. Maybe in your next feedback you can explain that feedback.
No,
don't, yeah, because we're going to ask, what do you mean by... Wait, so now we're feeding... Never mind. Okay, and that brings us to the end of the feedback for The Enemy. So we'll be back next week when we do The Price. Until next week, take care and good night.
Yep, good night again.